I gotta get out of this place. And I've borrowed the animals' line, even though, unlike them, I just need a vacation. Their song title may be a cliché that's set to three chords, but it's more than the sum of its parts. The stirrings it starts in listeners' thoughts could reset their bearings and send them away on a different course. My mind's ear will make the decision when I'm choosing where I might be bound. For me, it's a place's sound, the music, the murmuring landscapes and clamouring streets, that all other pleasures coalesce around. Aged about 16, I started listening to bands from California. Some records from LA, but more from San Francisco. I remember when I first put on the Working Man's LP and heard a sweet guitar line cut through the noisy vinyl like sun across the city's foggy bay I'd never seen. The Grateful Dead, who made that album, had a seedy, tattered look in the sepia-tinted photo on the cover. And the flip side of the high time in their music was uncertainty and pain as they sang about a dire wolf, a deadly speedway, and a driver on cocaine. I liked the record's imperfections. The voices were unpolished, but their characters and musical intentions were laid bare in their strivings. Jerry's gentle touch with Robert Hunter's lyrics, Weir's straight-ahead delivery, and Pigpen's darker style of singing. He inhabited the words in a reckless, headlong way. Ignoring the warnings behind him and before him, he died, aged 27, in 1973. I'm sometimes overwhelmed by music's strange recesses, the points within its textures where harmonies emerge from unfathomable places. Like the moment in the sequence on side two of Live in Europe, 72. The first of the two numbers is by Hunter and Garcia, and it leads into an instrumental section whose subtle interaction is driven by the bass and the guitars. And then a mood of calm, before those unexpected voices reach across the stillness from infinitely far. I know you, Ryder. Lay down last night, I could not take my rest, my mind was wandering. I wish I was a headlight on a train. I'd shine my lamp to try and make a pathway through the rain. I know you, Ryder. The very last refrain from that old song, sung a cappella. Going to miss me when I'm gone. Absences and distances, far wider than the stereo. Highways and railroads, sea to shining sea. Journeys much longer than any here in Britain, where our little motorways and A and B roads can't measure up against the USA. But the airplane and the dead and other lures and sirens haven't always been enough to drag my arse across the ocean in the face of the excuses I can find to sit around at home instead of making up my mind to go. Till finally last summer, I took a walk to challenge my inertia, along the Great West Road and the A4, from Austerley to Heathrow, where it's lunchtime on a Sunday. Congregations are emerging from the churches. Placards berate the less than pious. What do you think of Jesus? And the words from the reproaches. O my people, what have I done to thee? Or wherein have I wearied thee? Answer me. Around here there's no shortage of temptations and enticements for travellers coming in and out of London who've always sought refreshment on their journeys. In times gone by, those church-avoiding sinners would have patronised the coaching inns along the road to Slough. But now the drive-in trade belongs to Costa and McDonald's, while the names of former businesses are fading from buildings like the one near Henley's Roundabout that used to be a garage, the Airport Motor Radiator Co. They'd have done a roaring trade here with old-timers in their sports cars and jalopies. Might have even kept some spares behind the counter for what Biggles called his kite.
Look here, old man, we've landed just nearby, and we need a spot of oil plus a prop block and a pitot tube, a spark plug and perhaps a very light. You're saying no can do? But lots of other flying chums have told me about you and said that you'd be sure to see me right. Okay, old boy, there's no need to get shirty. You're clearly not the fella I was hoping to do business with today. It was many years ago, so I suppose that he sold up, or maybe snuffed it. And since I'm just a ghost myself, you shouldn't pay attention to anything I say. There's little space for phantoms as I close in on the airport,
and no equivocation on the posted prohibitions. Beware of special bylaws, mortal danger, no right of way for crusties or for climate change protesters. A warning to the curious, keep your distance. And now, above the barriers, an aircraft's tail is moving like an animal's across the fenced-off spaces, where giant metal creatures rumble as they taxi, make a revving surging when they hurtle down the runway, and with it a massive lengthy fart from the exhaust fumes, a sound and stink that linger in the air and boom around the highway. As I stood there, I suddenly recalled a dire warning from a colleague I had lunch with in the early 1980s. "You need to know," she told me, "that the tin of fizzy drink which you're consuming will give you indigestion. And also there's a chemical inside it that'll make you want another and another." She was right about the flatulence, but not the secret formula, as far as I'm aware. Oh, thank you. I don't mind if I do, but just the one, at least for now. For I was half expecting what happened near the airport. A product of the sound and the excitement and the smell, a sudden wild desire to find a plane to take me, as to where I didn't care, to hell with any planning. Was I in the throes of something like the craving that my colleague said I'd suffer after quaffing down my drink? Just imagine what the Greens would think if it was proven that the aircraft engine fumes I'd been inhaling contained a special substance like the dubious addition to my soda, making people want to jump aboard a plane and fly away into the blue, leaving behind them a trail of CO2. Mad for it! I even shouted out the stupid words. They were fortunately drowned in the reverberating noise, and there was nobody around. Mad for it! I needed to calm down, so I headed for a bus stop. But later in the day I went online to finalise my booking for some flights and a hotel. You'll probably have guessed my destination. Mad for it. Well, I think you bloody have to be to tolerate the levels of security before a long-haul flight. I always make an effort to blend in at the airport. Try to keep my movements smooth and calm and fluent. But as they're frequently disrupted, could it be I've got a kick-me sign that I can't see, stuck somewhere on my back or on my luggage? "Yes, you there, sir. Did you know you haven't got? It's not displaying. Something's triggering our sensors. Step aside here for a moment. You should have filled the form and take it off. I'm going to grope around in case there's any contraband within those hidden spaces. We apologise for all this inconvenience. False alarm." After that, I need a coffee. And the pleasant young barista smiles and asks me if I'm having a nice day. She's visibly put out when I reply, "Well, no, not really. But I'll soon be on my way." It strikes me that our plane is merely going through the motions as it starts its lumbering foreplay and heads towards the runway. We're all strapped down in joyless expectation, itchy and impatient. Now it pauses on the threshold, get on up. For the moment, we'll be pinned back in our seats. But takeoff is a going, not a coming. And already we can sense the dislocation in height and in relation to what's passing by below us. Slippery tension, like a piece of modern music that combines two separate meters and messes with our heads. All this is long before our bodies start to notice the onset of the jet lag that's its physical expression. To minimise it, I set my watch back and try to get my head around our geodesic pathway, mapped out in two dimensions on the tiny screen before me. It tells me San Francisco is 5,000 miles away, 10 hours in the air. Half the time it would have taken on planes that had prop engines, though even that was nothing compared to months at sea. And now we're nearly over Liverpool. I think of bygone sailors emerging from the port there and heading south past Holyhead en route to California round Cape Horn. In October 1850, the McDonald sailed from here to San Francisco via Chile. On board were 13 iron houses, fire bricks and bedsteads, mattresses and cisterns, and a boiler. 2 months later, the cargo of the Margaret included butter, wine and whiskey, iron goods, machines and engines, and devices to wash the 49ers' golden nuggets. There were often passengers as well, some listed unidentified in steerage. I know even less about the people seated near me. And now the guy beside the windows pulled its shade down, shutting out the sky and wing that were the only things in view. I paper over the looming empty hours and vacant spaces with thoughts about the progress of a ship called Lady Heathcote, the details of whose passage round the Horn to San Francisco in 1868 and 69 were recorded by her carpenter, George Mansfield. What makes a perfect witness? John le Carré says it's someone with no malice or personal opinion. Robert Harris in Gotcha suggests that Brian Hanrahan, reporting from the Falklands, was aided by his ignorance of warfare and his wonder at the power of its weapons. George Mansfield knew little of the ocean and nothing of the places he'd encounter. He misspells them in his journal and gets muddled as to dates when he's at sea. But he's a watcher, whose words about his voyage read like testimony from an honest copper on the stand, with a notebook in his hand. Towed out of dock in Liverpool at 7 in the morning on November the 11th, 1868, proceed to sea. Fresh breeze and foggy weather, and next day, when we're passing Bardsey Island, I watch it dipping in and out the water as our vessel falls and rises with the currents that are bearing us away. Soon the captain has to show his sway and stature. Two sailors are taken from the wheel, for they didn't know the compass and their steering was improper. Much later in the voyage, there's trouble with another of my shipmates, Johnson the Norwegian. He's reprimanded by the captain, and when others side with Johnson, I'm told to grind the cutlasses and get the firearms ready. Any mutiny is avoided by next morning when Johnson sees the captain and humbly begs his pardon. But for now, we're heading southwards past the island of Madeira. There'd been a whale beside us the afternoon before, and we collided in the darkness with a brig that had no lights up. It struck the mizzen rigging but did no serious damage, and we had no further sighting of the vessel. By Christmas Day, we're in the South Atlantic and are thinking of our loved ones far away. We know our longing cannot bring us back together, but trust that we will have a happy meeting by and by. In the meantime, we all enjoy our dinner, bouillon, Christmas pudding, and a fine plum cake for tea. There are even cheese and pickles from the galley, the last remaining morsels of the luxuries and treats we brought to sea. The changing seasons are a confusion. The weather in December is hotter than an English summer's day. But 1 month after, for all that it is now the height of summer off Cape Horn, the cold is more intense than any I've encountered. I don't know what it must be like in winter. On January the 14th, 1869, we sight the rugged mountains of Tierra del Fuego. Its peaks are topped with snow, yet here at sea it's warm and fine. The next day is a Friday. We're becalmed, and our sails are flapping listlessly. How long the wind is freshening. If conditions stay the same, we'll soon be up again to the equator. We make a splendid run, 200 miles a day, but the conclusion of the month is cold and wet, depriving us of almost any comfort, while February commences with very dirty weather. We're beginning to get tired of the passage, and I'm longing for the sight of California. I feel I'm in the doldrums at this point in our flight, though my misusing of the term would earn me the disdain of any sailor. For even though the plane has crossed the ocean and is nearing Hudson Bay, the readout of the mileage is a wearisome reminder that we've barely come halfway. And though the screen is showing tailwinds of 100 miles an hour, I can't feel them, and scarcely even register the engine's thrusting power. As to the places we fly over, I conceive them just as featureless expanses, mere distances to cover. So I sigh and pull my blanket closer. I'll liven up again once we've crossed into Montana. The carpenter's in better shape than I am, though a couple of his shipmates are ailing. Robert Dannelly's been suffering from derangement for nearly 2 months now, while another crewman's grievously afflicted with the piles. But most of us on board the Lady Heathcote are now indulging freely in the hope that we'll be spending just 2 more weeks at sea, for we're heading through the water at a splendid rate towards our destination. On March the 22nd, I glimpse the Farallon Islands, and in the afternoon the following day, the pilot comes on board to guide us into San Francisco Bay. He'd spent 4 months at sea,
But Mansfield doesn't tell us what he saw on reaching terra firma, or while he was ashore. He was soon on board the Heathcote once again, for she sailed from San Francisco on the 24th of April and was safely back in England by September. It won't be long until our own arrival. We're dazzled by the sunlight in the cabin as our lethargy gives way to feelings of community and pleasant, if sporadic, conversation. I think the reason is the nearing, warming presence of the city. We aren't yet quite in sync with what's beneath us. But after touchdown, when we stumble past vacated rows of seats towards the exit door, the crumpled stuff they leave behind in business class is just as stale and nasty as our garbage in economy. We will be. You'd better watch it. The phrase can cover a range of meanings, from outright threats to friendly warnings. It's like a turn-up on the trousers of acceptable behaviour to stop things falling downward any further. You go beyond it, or take your pants off at your peril. You wouldn't wander naked into US immigration, and you shouldn't accidentally tick the boxes on the ESTA form confessing you're a spy or saboteur. I nearly did so, but my error was flagged up by the software. Is that really what you meant? In other words, you'd better watch it. I was grateful. Howdy, stranger. There's something sinister about that greeting. Words you might expect from guys in cowboy hats and western ties, but not the average Californian. It draws attention to my status, for I know that I'm a stranger, and recognise that therefore I'm to some degree a sucker, an innocent abroad by definition, the sort of person who's at risk of being taken for a ride, who misjudges things and fails to read the signs. At best a subject for indulgent toleration, such people don't know any better. At worst, potentially, a victim. So as a sucker and a stranger, I'd be well advised to watch it. And as I head downtown on BART, my jet-lagged introspection begs a question. What am I bringing with me? Well, flicking through the checklist, nothing that's illegal, nothing that's for sale, nothing that's infectious. But aside from this, a bundle of attitudes and ways like stiffened muscles that need manipulation. I may have had a taste of the essence of this place from books and from TV, on vinyl and CD and MP3. But still, the nitty-gritty of living and transacting here is alien to me. For the spirit and the workaday are never quite in harmony. Imagine you're a regular attender at a church, accustomed to its liturgy, familiar with the stands and sits, and tolerant of the cold. But one day you make a visit to another house of God, where ye and thee are absent from the readings and the prayers. The central heating works, and signs of peace are made with warm embraces instead of sheepish handshakes. Yet whatever the resultant shyness and discomfort, such incompatibilities are merely different outer ways to manifest a message all believers share in essence. So you decide to get in tune with these good people, your brothers and your sisters, notwithstanding their unfamiliarities, and try to readjust to your surroundings, but quickly find it's easier said than done. Will the choir turn towards the altar, watch the traffic, it's coming from a different direction? How much should you put in the collection? Does my debit card work here? I'm not sure what to tip the waiter. I love your accent. If you're English in the USA, steer clear of words like actually. You fucking bastard! What's with this guy? Yes, I knew I'd better watch it. We're at Powell, where the numbers of the homeless and the desperate have grown since the last time I was here. I'd stopped to sort my tickets out and straight away attracted some attention. The ranting man was running round the station, scarcely begging, just cursing and demanding. I encountered others like him on my way along the street as darkness fell. Their shouting and their cries were like a bitter serenade amid the clanging cable cars. And to shut out all the din, lots of visitors and locals had their headphones connected to their mobiles. They'd sealed themselves inside a system that limits interaction with the people that surround them and the traffic at the junctions. I appreciate their reasons. Even read about a playlist of songs that you should listen to at various locations round the city. and I'm sure the music's fine, but on my own perambulations I'd like to hear those places as they are. While, misguidedly maybe, I want to keep the solemn stillness that, paradoxically, we sing of in It Came Upon the Midnight Clear at Christmas. Unlike its author, Edmund Sears, a Massachusetts pastor, I've little faith in heaven's all-gracious king. But could it be that ever the Babel sounds of San Francisco, the blessed angels sing? All travellers to this city must pay homage to the ocean and the Golden Gate. Though in doing so we struggle with the infinite, reach out into parallels and metaphors, or glance across at how our literary betters, with their finer minds and clearer grasp of scripture and mythology, convey the depths and magnitudes that lap against our fragile little citadels of certainty. For when the subject is the sea, their thoughts and ours are filled with archetypal monsters whose resonance and names, Charybdis, Leviathan and Kraken, are always there in our imagination. There are other gentler beings in the poems of the ocean, like Thomas Shadwell's kindly tritons, attending voyages on Purcell's halcyon days. But those deep waters never lose their dark associations. Paul Theroux was right about the people who gaze in death's direction as they sit inside their cars along the English shoreline, staring in silence at the sea. And yet it's all too tempting to misapply such images. What might be true in Britain, or fitting for a Greek or Roman myth, or in the Bible, may simply not belong in other places. And if we settle for a cliché, or the merely picturesque in our descriptions, we can end up stuck in Davy Jones's locker, or drowning in the waters of the Silvery Tay. I want to cast aside such formulae today, tear them from my mind, and watch them sink like tissue paper in the sea. The wind here on the bridge is fierce and leaves me gasping, though it also keeps me moving and my vertigo at bay. The traffic passing by me on State Route 1 and US 101 doesn't linger either, and gives me a reminder of what the bridge is for. While it certainly fulfilled a grandiose ambition, proclaimed at its inaugural fiesta in 1937, the completion of a smooth, unbroken highway from Canada to Mexico, it also boosted the local and commercial. The fiesta had its own official sandwich, while if you fancied something sweeter, you could, to quote the ad, say Ghirardelli to the vendor, and sped up journey times around the region, which led to traffic jams and helped to put the ferries out of business. In short, it was and is a means, a structure that for all its high-flown wonder forms a grounded, guaranteed support for San Franciscans' undertakings. A unifying presence, not a yoke or overlay, and a part of a new world that pays no tribute to the jealous gods and creatures of other distant seas. To my right, I see the city, its creator, a haven and a fortress, Oro en Paz, Fiero en Guerra. One that has its own Madonna, identified, I've read, as Santa Niebla, Our Lady of the Fogs, Ave Maristella. A place of sweet arrival and provision, and a gateway for departure. Why am I so reluctant to look out the other way, towards the ocean? I'm not afraid of Cetus or of Scylla, not here in the Pacific. I don't think even death is waiting out there in the water, but maybe there's a Roman myth that's legal tender here, the one of Janus. Unlike him, though, I'm smiling as I gaze inland. I can't read my other face, the one that contemplates the vastness. I thought I'd try to find a pub in Cambridge, whose exact location I'd forgotten, though I had a vague idea of its direction and its distance from the centre of the town. So I pictured little details, the menu on its blackboard and the sawdust on its floor, and tried to use them like a kind of pathway to guide me through the streets towards its door. I didn't really know where I was going, but after half an hour I'd somehow made it to that bar, where my beer and the sandwich from its kitchen were just as good as I'd been hoping for. This morning, waking up in San Francisco, I recalled the smell of croissants and coffee being roasted from somewhere in Pacific Heights I'd been to years before. Could my instinct lead me back towards that cafe? Was it even in business anymore?
What the hell, the sun was shining. I felt game for anything. Put my street map in my pocket and checked I had a notebook to write down what I saw. Well, I'd surely earned a snicker from the city's genius loci, and I'd forgotten just how steep the climb would be, while on my breathless way northwest, other coffee outlets propositioned me. Howdy, stranger. Take a load off. Use the restroom. Why not have a cappuccino and a complimentary Danish? But instead I kept right on, like Harry Lauder. Found a bus to take me up Van Ness, then split off to the west. Where I think my ESP would barely scrape a beta minus, for I couldn't find the cafe, though I did locate a nearby satisfactory place to get my breakfast. And over coffee I at least arrived at something, a conclusion. Mere intuition doesn't cut it as a means to rediscover the locations of former tastes and feelings. Its small successes are barely more than serendipity. To shift my focus past myself and onto what this place can show to me, I need to find a better way. I'd like to try one out round Kearney, Pacific, and the streets towards the bay. A patriotic question in a physics book at school asked us to calculate how many molecules of Nelson's dying breath might still be present in the atmosphere. Would the figure for the remnants of the brothels and the dives and the theatres and saloons that once stood here be just about as minuscule? I've seen the pictures, but fire and changing mores have done away with all those places. It said the Barkers and the Madams didn't like their customers to share too many details about the goings-on. It's strange to think the status of a house of ill repute might depend upon the Hookers and the Johns all keeping shtum. But without the spurious lure of secrecy, initiates shouldn't speak of what they see or what they've done, I'm not sure there have been that many takers. Nighttime glimpses, if a window or a door was left ajar, would only interest a peeping Tom or prowler. While in the light of day we'd see the stains and creases on the sheets and pillowcases in all their ugly clarity. I could be wrong in any way, we're dealing now with history, particles and photographs and fragments. With the curious exception of the soundtracks for these spots of dissipation, whose transitory music has left surviving traces. It was mostly nothing more than a commodity, sounds to grab attention, the blaring gramophones and steam pianos. Sounds to have a dance to. This punter's overwhelmed by easy pleasure when the band begins to play. They play such jolly music, waltz, polka and quadrille, and sometimes play so feelingly, it gives me quite a thrill. Songs to sing along to. The words appeared on broadsides, published in their thousands by companies like Boyd's at Montgomery and Pine. They can't be read today without a shudder, though the ghastly titled Pretty Octoroon, dressed in the height of fashion with a darling roguish eye, would draw immense applause for a minstrelsy performer called Joe Murphy, who sang and played the bones at a music hall nearby. Other local venues hosted more distinguished artists, pianist Sid Liprotti, and even on Columbus, Mr. Jelly Roll himself from New Orleans. But did their customers esteem those finer sounds? Were they aficionados? Or was the music just a background for a card game, some dancing, and whatever else went down? I'd like to think that the musicians knew their compositions could never be confined within those seedy spaces. The other stuff, however, found its fate among the rubble and the ashes, although it still emits some faint vibrations. Remember me? Well, no. And all I've done today is try to listen for your echo. But now it's time to go. Some cities present us with immaculate facades. Some are diamonds in the rough. A few are turds. But San Francisco's gleam and glow can be tracked throughout the day. I begin at Old St. Mary's, whose clock displays a warning to sojourners like me. Son, observe the time. And fly from evil. Am I guilty this morning of the deadly sin of sloth by standing here and taking in the cascading silver sheen from sunlight on deliveries of fish in Chinatown? Well, Ecclesiastes says that truly the light's a sweet and pleasant thing to see. So I give myself a pass and climb higher up Knob Hill to catch the rays of afternoon on the buildings and the ocean, while at close of day, now we are come to the sun's hour of rest, my chosen vantage point, the lights of evening round us shine, is Pioneer Park, we hymn the Father, where what I see, sun, although I don't ascribe, and Holy Spirit, the wonder of the scene to any deity divine, somehow comes across more finely in those verses by John Keble, translated from the Greek, Phos Hilaron, hail, gladdening light, even though he never came here, than by any words of mine. A city's partially defined by the attitude it strikes as its suburbs encroach on vacant space and wilderness. The roads gain traffic lights and intersections, and there are signs for local destinations instead of less specific indications, west and south, or merely highway numbers. I was weary on a journey down the seaboard I'd taken with a colleague some 15 years ago. The 4x4 we'd hired was much the worse for wear, and our hollow-eyed demeanour must have showed, for when we stopped to get some gas outside the city, a passer-by came over to ask us rather warily, "You guys, how long have you been on the road?" We were pleased to see a friendly face after previous encounters with some cops. "You fellas round that light, are you from Ireland?" And a threatening pair of hunters who'd driven close behind us through the forests up the coast. I'd had enough of backwoods and of trees, I have to say. I was eager to return to urban life and for somewhere on a city street to stay. But first we had to make it into town and get ourselves off Highway 101, which, it seemed to me, didn't want us to break free. Was there a false knight on this road, like in the ballad, a trickster or a demon whose questions must be parried with suitable replies? How might our conversation with him be? "What brings you here so late? How will you go by land? How will you go by sea?" "There's a bridge to span the waters of the bay. We'll stay in lane, obey the signs, and it isn't very late, not even lighting up time yet." "You must be Brits to talk like that. So tell me, what you got in back?" "Our bundles and our books." "Okay, but what's that in your hand?" "It's nothing but a map. We're looking for an exit." "Ha ha, got you there. Wrong way." "But we didn't make a turn, and there are 10 more miles to go." "That's what you reckon? Your map is out of date. Come on, you guys don't even know which way you're headed." "Hey, I think I hear a bell." "Yes, it's ringing you to hell." "Oh, shit, I guess you know the song. So now I'll have to let you go. I could recommend a cheap motel." "That's kind of you, but no." For as we closed in on the city, the roads beyond the off-ramps were like ribbons from a trailing silken garment lying softly by the highway. And the place names on the signs were sonorous enticements. Mill Valley, Sausalito. Then something more prosaic, exit 437, Presidio, Marina Boulevard. The route off 101 towards our bed and breakfast in Cow Hollow. On that trip, I was able to check out the little boxes that Malvina Reynolds scoffed at in her song. They're on the slopes of Daly City, and I found their vivid colours undeserving of her scorn. Her number surely served its purpose as a tool in the progressive's endless struggle and a big hit for Pete Seeger. But time passes, targets shift, and I dare say if Malvina still were with us, she'd be fighting on a different front today. And I see she had a master's and a doctorate from Berkeley, whose other students have included Dr. Leary, LSD, Steve Wozniak of Apple, Jack London, Susan Sontag. None of them conformists like the stereotype she sang of. But anyway, her alma mater's peaceful on this sunny afternoon. There's a feeling of transition as I take the short walk east from Berkeley Station to the campus. Do the air vents from its buildings exude the scent of scholarship and protest, confrontation and free speech? No, it's just the eucalyptus. And despite our easy access to the paths and open spaces, security is strict, and though we're welcome in the cafes and the pizza joints and bookshops, other doors are closed politely in our faces. To any stranger's knowledge of this city and this country, there are limits.
We'll never see material stamped with no fawn, spook speak, not for eyes of foreign nationals. While in daily interactions we stand apart like pebbles, left unshaped and dry by tides that residents are always in the swim of. I'm sure we'd be more skilful at hiding in plain sight if we were really spies. And we cling to our distortions and delusions like children to their teddies, to words from other visitors that may have little resonance for native San Franciscans. Stevenson's description of indefinite prolongation of its streets, and Oscar Wilde's assertion, anyone who disappears is said to be seen here. I know it's an imperfect simile, but the city's lofty stacks of buildings seem to me like shelving in a library, a place where almost anyone can occupy a niche and gain a label. In 1921, Almira Bailey wrote of old American stock, lumberjacks, philosophers, Mexicans, Sinn Feiners, Chinamen in slippers, turbaned Hindus, Portuguese, and many others at the port. Thankfully, diversity today is flagged up more respectfully, for San Francisco needs its passers through, and immigrants, and strangers. Since Gold Rush days, there's been an urgency and longing to arrive here. In a story by Samuel Adams Drake, 1850s vessels berthed in Boston Harbour carried signs upon their riggings declaring they were headed with dispatch for San Francisco. But now, as a result of the contagion that's gripping California and the nation, we've seen the digital displays of airline cancellations and the plight of passengers in Oakland aboard the Grand Princess who had the virus. Nothing fundamental in the elements has changed. Tides and jet streams haven't lost their power to bring us in on ships and planes. But till it's safe to come and go, would-be visitors can only wait at home for favourable conditions. And at a time when facile comments and half-truths and evasions are two a penny from our politicians, outsiders ought to weigh their words with care. I'm well aware my own uncertainties regarding my return have no significance to anyone but me. But I look forward to the day when I hear the city ask me in again, with a whisper on the breeze across the bay.